Hey, and welcome to the...
Oh, you bastard.
Sorry. What up, nerds? Welcome to episode 96 of The Unwind, a weekly show where we talk about tech, games, gadgets, and geek culture. My name is Rob Steller.
I'm Sean Thomas.
And I'm Josiah Hills.
So, do you guys like John Marston? What do you guys think about John Marston?
I don't know who that
is. He's a very sexy voice.
He does. Red Dead Redemption 2 just got announced.
Yeah.
I don't even know. I just want to tell you guys.
I kind of liked how they announced it.
It was.
They did the legit announcement?
Well, yeah. Was it 2 days ago? I think they started with it, right?
So they posted
just like a red image, right?
With Rockstar in red.
Right. Yeah.
And people immediately were like, this looks like the Red Dead colors.
Right.
And then
yesterday, they posted a silhouette of seven cowboy-looking folk.
It's the new one. It's a fantasy version of Red Dead.
And then today they actually came out and said, I think it's coming out fall of next year.
Yeah, or so it is definitely 2017.
So another year, yeah.
Unfortunately, it's only PS4 and Xbox One. And oddly enough, they didn't have a PC release for Red Dead Redemption.
But they did for GTA 5.
They did. So this is
but
the funny
well
thing.
After they released on consoles.
Yeah, the caveat with that is they waited for the PS4 and Xbox One release to put it on PC. So I can kind of understand maybe they were waiting to up the visuals or something. It's actually weird. I mean, for GTA, I'm pretty sure every GTA has been on PC. I think 3 was, 4 definitely was, and 5 was. So I might be wrong about 3. That may not have been on PC. I don't remember. But either way, all those were on there. They've had a lot of games on PC, but for whatever reason, they didn't put Red Dead on, which is one of their biggest franchises.
GTA 1 and 2 were PC exclusive.
Yeah, I remember playing GTA 2. But either way, an interesting point about it, though, it was all over the news, well, on like tech and gaming sites. And it was funny, people pointed out there are very few games that could garner this much attention off one tweet.
Yeah.
There definitely are games, but...
What would those games be, Sean?
Shenmue. No, but like...
Half-Life 3?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Half-Life 3 would be on another level, but... I think it's weird. I mean, I don't know if this was considered a gaming unicorn, but it almost feels like another one of the unicorns that are actually happening, like Final Fantasy VII, The Last Guardian, Shenmue, something else. What just got recently announced? There's something else that was another one of the unicorns that you're like, wait, they're making...
Duke Nukem?
Toe Jam and Earl's son?
Okay. None of those, but either
no,
way.
No, that's happening.
That
don't
is.
Take that away from
is
me.
It already
well,
done?
It's Kickstarter. Yeah. No.
I can't believe I can't think of the game. But either way, it's cool to see Red Dead. I'm excited. Sounds like Rob's excited. Josiah might be mildly
excited. I never finished the first one. Like I found it way, 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 way after it came out.
I found out about it last year. So.
I played it for a while. I think I got about halfway through. Definitely liked the Western feel of it. I'm very excited, having been a big fan of GTA 5 and everything that they were able to put into that. I'm very excited what Rockstar is going to be able to do with this.
One of my favorite things is when people take settings or genres or something that and make it interesting. So genres that I'm not interested in at all, I love it when they can find a way. So I really don't care about the Wild West, and I really like the setting in that game.
That's not what your cowboys...
Clank.
Wiki, wow. Is that what?
Wow.
Come on, man. Will Smith's
son? Best cowboy.
Will Smith knew how to do it, man.
No words after that. No words.
But one comparison I have is Mad Men. I really didn't care much about that era, and I really loved that show. So
you didn't
care
about 1960s advertising?
No, I didn't. No, it wasn't.
That
it
was on the top of my list.
The best way to sum it up is she knew he was married. moving on. So Bill Belichick, the head coach of the New England Patriots, hates tablets. So there's a really funny GIF that's going around.
Microsoft tablets, yeah.
Well, okay.
He hates his team. I think he just took it out on the surface.
I don't remember. Was this 2 weeks ago when they had the first loss of their season? There's a funny GIF going around where he basically has his Surface. And by the way, it's like all rubberized because obviously they have these like super damage-proof tablets, and he literally just throws it at like the ground or something like that, and he just hates it. And he came out today saying, "I'm not using tablets. I'm going to pen and paper." A lot of it talked about how you know, it's the Surface, and people have joked about, so the NFL forced or they have a partnership with Microsoft, so everybody is using the Surface tablet. I mean, maybe it had to do with the Surface. I don't know. I don't know if the iPad would have been better, but I think it kind of goes into, we're coming into, in generally in the work environment, it's kind of bring your own device. And this is also showing how much the device you want to use and what works for you is often the best. And so he was forced to use the Surface because everybody in the NFL is used, has to use these Surface tablets. And I don't even know if the iPad would work better, or it's just he's kind of a Luddite and he wants to use pen and paper. But it kind of shows, like, when you can use your own device, it works better. And sometimes forcing technology, especially him, he's not exactly a young guy. It doesn't always work. So I don't know what will actually happen, especially because I'm sure Microsoft paid the NFL a lot of money, but I don't know if the NFL can do anything. I mean, it's Bill Belichick.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what the agreement was, and if there's any repercussions here, if he needs to pay a fine or something like that. Because, I mean, this is a huge marketing blow, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's very embarrassing. It's not quite exploding phones, but it's pretty bad. And, you know, I did read a couple articles, skimmed over a couple articles about this, and you know, he didn't give specifics, at least not in the articles. They didn't say, like, what was going on, but he in general said that it was, like, inconsistent and unreliable. So I'm guessing whatever app they were running or whatever, which is probably a custom app, so, you know, there's a good chance that it's not actually related to the Surface. But and more based on the app developer, but like I said, I didn't see any specific details, but he did say it was inconsistent and unreliable. So
it would be funny if in his rant he referred to it as an iPad, because that was another huge marketing blow. A lot of people didn't know what the Surface was, and you know, like, they're paid, they have to say what tablet is, and they either called it iPads or they just called it tablet,
yeah,
something generic, and that was a big thing. And you make a good point of what the marketing deal is. But honestly, this isn't unheard of. So I don't know if it was last year, a couple years ago, Colin Kaepernick was wearing Beats headphones.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
they're,
he got fined.
Yeah, the, you know, Bose pays the NFL so that everybody has to wear Bose headphones. The thing is, they get so much publicity. Beats didn't care. They'll pay Colin Kaepernick. I mean, he could pay it anyway, but they'll pay him the fine. They don't really care because it's a tiny fine for them to pay. So that's just interesting. We'll see what happens. It'll be kind of funny to see him with pen and paper. Then I kind of want to move into, so the presidential race is heating up, and Hillary Clinton had, Donald Trump has his obvious faux pas, but I think the thing that has come up for Hillary recently is that her email was hacked, and a lot of it came out in these WikiLeaks releases. And I don't know. I'm not sure if I want to get into all the politics of it, because that is a whole thing into itself. But how do you guys feel the fact that this was clearly hacked out of, I think it's her like her manager, her campaign manager, John Podesta's account.
Yep.
And it potentially could be Russian involvement. How do you feel about this kind of stuff getting out? Because obviously this really happened.
So this is interesting. And I'm kind of struggling with this, right? Because it's like, on the one hand, like, well, all this shit happens, but now we can just see it. So it's not like this shit didn't happen before. It's just that it was not public, right? So part of it's like, well, it's kind of unfair because we kind of get this information that should not be out there. But on the other hand, it's like, well, all this shit was there. It's real. Like, this happened.
And so
I've been like struggling with, like, this is, I don't, when was WikiLeaks started? Do you know?
I don't know how long ago.
Is this the first debate that, like, WikiLeaks has?
No,
it's coming up on 10 years.
10 years,
yeah. So it's been out.
10-year anniversary.
But there was nothing like.
But like these types of hacks are relatively recent, right? So like this just didn't happen before. So I don't know. It's something I'm struggling with, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like Rob said. This stuff happened. It's been, you know, now that it's out there, we get to see it, and I don't know if we should say, well, they have some privilege and they shouldn't be hacked or what have you. I guess I would like people not to hack presidential candidates, right. Yeah. Or hack me, or hack anybody. But that's not very realistic in this world that we live in. And so, you know, so what's the outcome? Do we say, well, don't talk like that anymore, and you go back to mafia style, like right. whispering into each other's ears? Or do we say, well, shame on WikiLeaks or whomever hacked them? Or do we say, you know, well, we get even tighter security, and or shame on the candidates for using, you know, lax security? I don't know what the
yeah.
result is. I do feel very uncomfortable. I feel like WikiLeaks loses some credibility. And I didn't have a high opinion of them anyway in the first place, but they lose credibility to me when they start releasing these email very close to the election, and they seem to be targeting one candidate over the other. So to me, that's, like I said, I don't have a high opinion of them to start with, but my opinion doesn't really affect what they do.
I will say, I think the worst part of this hack that I'm, the thing I'm actually seriously against, I've heard that there was a lot of sensitive data that was put out there, like social security numbers and things related to a lot of senators. And that's kind of stuff, that's the kind of thing where typically if it was sent through a newspaper or some other big publication,
yeah.
they would vet it and take that kind of stuff out.
Yeah,
and I don't.
That's always been my complaint. I'm not against knowing information
right.
that might, you know, change your opinion. I welcome new data, but it's like, have some professionalism.
I will say, though, to be fair, I don't think Donald Trump thought that his recording with Billy Bush, the Access Hollywood one, would ever be released. And I mean, clearly, I don't think anybody is really saying he shouldn't have been recorded. Like, that is something that's out there. And to be fair, like, yes, it wasn't hacked, but clearly it was audio that wasn't on the show, and technically he wasn't in a capacity where he
that doesn't bother me at all. I mean, it, you know, there's the mic'd moments, right? Like, it happens to every politician where they think their mic is turned off,
yeah.
and they say something that's embarrassing. That to me is I don't think that's the same thing, right? Like, when I send you an email and type your name in the address, or your email address in the bar right there, like, I expect that communication to be between you and
yeah,
I,
yeah.
right? So it's a very, very different thing to say, oh, well, I'm mic'd and there are people around, because there were still people around, and it could have just been somebody overhearing them and then reporting it years later. So I don't have any pity for him on that. And to the point, you know, it's really showing his true nature. Like, how many times does he have to say really mean, nasty, yeah. misogynistic, racist things for people to believe that finally, yes, oh, he might be racist and misogynistic and sexist and all these other things? It's really bizarre to me. But I mean, email, I think, is very different.
Well, moving on from that, one other thing I want to talk about was, so there's, I don't want to get into all the details of it, but there was a app called Dash. I believe it's called Dash.
Yeah.
I never use it. And there was some controversy because it got pulled because the app developer had a linked account that had been doing fraudulent things. It ended up being a big deal because it was a really well-known app. It was a very good app, and people were very supportive of the developer. He only made, I mean, that was his only app, and so people trusted him. One thing I thought was cool about it, though, some stuff is still happening, but after he, after his app got pulled, immediately a lot of the bigger people in the Apple community, like John Gruber, Marco Arment, they tweeted in support of him. And I'm pretty sure that's one of the things that catapulted it to into the interest of Apple. I mean, I'm sure Apple realized, like, this is a fairly well-known app, but I thought it was interesting that that kind of power did elevate it, and Apple took notice. Because I heard that Phil Schiller, who I think works on app relationships or with developers,
yeah.
he was specifically worried about that app in particular, and he was taking some
yeah.
of it on.
Well, do you know the resolution?
So I've heard as most recently, so it kept going back and forth where basically Apple wanted him to admit that there was this linked account and there's fraudulent activity. He didn't want to admit that because he felt like he wasn't at fault for it. And I don't know, did they ever reinstate it, his app?
I don't know if they've reinstated it, but there is resolution. He was in the wrong. He's 100% in the wrong, and he admitted
it. Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So that's the part that I hope doesn't get lost.
Oh,
right?
I didn't know.
Because
that.
There's been this narrative for the last 10 years of like, oh, the App Store is such a closed ecosystem and shit gets pulled for no reason. And you know, they're anti-developers. And yet developers keep flocking to the App Store and keep making more money than on Google Play. Right. So like there's this disconnect. I get that it might be difficult. And when you've, you know, as a developer, you're going to feel like, oh, my life is in the hands of Apple. Right. If that's your all, like you've invested everything into it, it can be a very scary thing to feel like I don't have control over this. But he actually he recorded a phone call.
Yeah.
And I listened to the whole what he released. And they were going back and forth and saying what you just described, Sean. Like the Apple representative was saying, yep, Phil is aware of this. He really wants you to say that blah, blah, blah. And you know, if you want to write a blog post and send it to us, we'll take a look at it. And then when we approve it, we'll get your app back on the store. And what they wanted him to say was that they wanted him to admit that there was his bank account where they send money. Was linked to another account which had fraudulent reviews. And that is 100% true. He finally said, okay, here's the deal. When I first started developing for iOS and Mac platforms, I made 3 or 4 different apps that were just, you know, testing the waters, and his mother set up the bank account. And they're in Eastern Europe. I don't know exactly what country. But so his mother set up the bank account, and she actually made an app. And so they had published maybe 3 or 4. And then when he built Dash, it started doing very well. And it's just a library repository to make programming and coding faster on Xcode. And so because of the nature of it, it's very popular with developers, which is the crowd that kind of tweeted and went apeshit. Yes. And so he said he started working on Dash, and then he said to his family, and this is all in his own words, he wrote this blog post and released it. And he said, you know what, I'm going to close these other ones and just work on Dash. And his family convinced him. They're like, no, revenue's still coming in. So they convinced him to just leave it be and let them manage it. And while he was working on Dash, his bank account was still this. It was still the same bank account. So he made a new Apple account, but it was still the same bank account that was going to his family. And so when he finally, and so they over the last few years were doing these illegal or not illegal, but fraudulent.
Yeah,
reviews.
There were a lot of fake reviews. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So they said over 1,000, and so he. He actually, it's unclear from his own words when he knew that his family was doing this, but he did know this when he was on the phone and recorded that phone call.
He knew that they were making fraudulent reviews?
I mean, he was, based on what he said, I would be shocked if he wasn't able to piece it together, right? Like he knew, oh yeah, because in the phone call, he keeps saying like, no, that's not my account. That's not my account. But the guy was very clear. He kept saying, well, we get that it's not your account. Nobody's saying it's your account, but it's linked to the same bank account.
Yeah.
And it's linked to the same developer account. And, it's linked to the same developer device, because you have to like register your device or something when you do certain testing. And he's like, it's linked to the same devices. It's linked to the same bank account. Nobody's saying it's you, but it's linked to these things. And so, in our eyes, we had to close this bank account and all apps attached to this bank account. And so when he's on the phone with him, he has to know, oh yeah, this is my mother and the rest of my family.
Yeah.
He had to know at least that much.
That's true.
He might say, well, I don't believe that they're doing these false accounts or fraudulent reviews.
Yeah, but he had
but
to.
Whatever
know,
it is,
yeah.
He had to know that was his mother.
The only curious thing, and so the weird thing, I did read up to that point, and it seems odd that he wouldn't, admit. And they were trying. They were from the phone call I heard. They were being pretty friendly about it. It's like just say that they were linked, and they're not saying that it's you doing it. That there was something linked, so that they aren't saying. So they're they're not admitting that they just randomly did it and decided to shut him down.
Yeah.
The only two curious things, I'm surprised, and he said this, so Apple did inform that account that there's fraudulent activity and they warned them multiple times, but they never informed his account. So he didn't know that was happening.
Right.
That was a little odd.
I can see that happening, though. I think it is a little odd because they were sending it to the email on file of the fraudulent account.
Yeah.
But when they closed it, so they said, well, it's linked to this other bank account. You'd think that they'd look up the one that's linked to the bank account and send that one an email as well. So I do think that's a little fishy, but...
But either way, I don't think that,
they're in the right. Yeah,
and people sound like they really trust him. So I think he specifically pointed out, like, this wasn't me doing fraudulent activity; it was something linked to me.
Yeah.
In the same way, Apple wants to say we don't dislike this app developer; we just saw this and it was connected to him. So it could have been easier.
So I don't hold anything against him. I know it's very embarrassing, and like he didn't want to sell out his family and all that stuff. But it's frustrating because. Because reporters like to sell their narrative, right? And there's been this narrative for the last 10 years that the Apple Store is, it's a bunch of bullies who just want to do what they want to do, and they register, they're keeping developers from doing awesome shit, right? Like if the Apple Store would just get out of the way, the App Store would just get out of the way with their reviews and all this stuff and their policies, then there'd be amazing, amazing apps. That's the narrative that I feel reporters have been telling for the last 10 years. And they were so ready to just jump on in support of this guy and say, yep, that's what they're doing. And to me, that's upsetting because it's not reporting, right? Like, I get that Twitter is this public forum and stuff like that, but when you have reporters vetting, vouching for this guy when they don't even know the story, I'm like, time out. That's your job. When you're on Twitter, you can't decide to be sometimes a private citizen and sometimes a reporter because you use it under your real name and people know that you're a reporter. So that I take issue with, and it's really unfortunate.
I mean, honestly, though, I can understand how Apple has that view. I mean, they don't have a Ballmer figure who can say developers multiple times in a row. I don't
and sweat through their shirt.
I don't think Tim Cook could ever do something like that. But anyway, moving on to this was one of the biggest news in recent months. The Note 7 is completely dead. So we haven't really covered this much. But if you've been living under a rock, so the Galaxy Note 7, they started exploding. And so my understanding is they started smoking pretty violently. They obviously stopped working. But they were initially, like, I think there was just like one small report, so you think maybe there's a bad one. But then reports just kept coming in, particularly in bad circumstances, like on airplanes. There's one video that eventually came out and somebody like passed out in the video. At some point, it was getting to a point where it was really bad. They ended up doing a recall late. And this was late when they ended up doing it, but they did a recall and then they sent out replacement devices. The replacement devices also had the same exact issue. So at this point, the Note 7 is completely dead. They said they're recalling all the phones. They're not selling it anymore. Even in like places like India that hasn't shipped yet, they're going to get some other phone. They're giving some nominal credit or something if you exchange it for another Galaxy device. But at this point, the Galaxy Note 7 is dead, and that's big because, it's big on many levels. First of all, the Note 7 was considered at the time the best Android device to get, and it was Samsung. I mean, they're by far the best manufacturer of Android phones in terms of at least sales on the Android side. There's that. Also, this wasn't just like, I mean, I've heard of fires like this happening or things, and sometimes it's like a pop and a puff of smoke, which is bad. Don't get me wrong. If a phone dies on you and there's a puff of smoke, that's never good. But this was like dangerous. There were reports of it burning through like the floor, not through all the layers, but like through some flooring of an airplane. Like this was
it burnt the carpeting. Yes, the phones malfunctioned and caught on fire, and there were several that did this, right? But the types of fires are no more, so fire, dangerous. Fire on a plane, very dangerous. But the types of fires were very similar in line with what you'd expect to see with a lithium ion battery catching on fire, right? So there have been reports of, I forget which number, but an iPhone did this, and they actually found out that, like, oh, well, the iPhone did this because this guy replaced the screen on a third party, and they actually screwed into, like, the batteries, the screws were, like, a half millimeter too long, and they screwed into the battery and it eventually exploded, right? But that type of explosion and fire is no different than the type of explosion and fire that that Sony had with their laptop. Like, one of their laptops did this a few years back, and it's no different than the fire that were on the new Boeing planes a couple years back, because they did a lot of battery stuff in the cabin, and there was a report of the plane actually catching on fire because of the lithium ion batteries. It's the chemistry is there, right? It's chemistry and physics. When these things go bad, they catch on fire, and the types of fires that you had and the heat involved and the energy released is no different from the Samsung Galaxy Note 7 versus any other lithium ion battery. The problem is that they exploded and caught on fire in the first place, and that they were doing them at much higher numbers than expected. Yeah. Typically, it's like 1 in 10 million, and I think this was about 100 times worse. So, you know, you can still say, well, that's 1 in 10 million? So it's 1 in 100,000, which is still a very large number or a very small percentage, but it's starting to feel realistic, right? Because you know they sell millions of these phones, and so it starts to get a little crazy there.
Yeah, and it's funny because so after the recall happened, there were a lot of people who liked the phone enough that they're like, oh, I'll just take my chances. Actually, one of our friends did the same thing. He was just like, I still want the Note 7. Like, that's the phone I want. And it's really funny for a lot of reasons, but I mean, especially after you see how consistently it's happening. And now it's on another level.
I misread that. It's about 10 times worse. So it's about 1 in a million that were catching on fire.
Okay.
But still, that's...
It felt like way more reports than I had heard from any phone.
Yeah.
The other thing was that now it is banned on all flights. I believe just in the U.S., but I assume it might expand. I think other airlines internationally are doing that.
Yeah.
So you can't even have it powered down. You can't take it on a plane. And actually, I read something today that Samsung is having kiosks at airports so that people can exchange
their
phone.
How do they know if you have one? Like, is it just if they see it, they'll kick you out?
That's what I think it is. I've been on flights and they've said the whole announcement with that, and it's not like anybody looked.
I don't know if they're asking TSA to look at it, but you're supposed to put your phone in the bin and they can see it on the scanners when you walk through.
That's true.
So if they see that you're hiding a phone in your bag or on your person, they'll, regardless of what phone it is, they'll ask you to take it out. And so I don't know if they're actively checking the bins, but they potentially could.
So there are a lot of things to unpack. We can't get into everything. One interesting thing was the way the recall worked. The recall, a lot of people were criticizing them for being slower than they should have been with the recall, considering how much the severity just ratcheted up. And I think one big problem they had was, my understanding is when they put out the replacement devices, they thought they had solved the issue and they weren't able to reproduce it in their test devices. So they thought they had solved it. Clearly they hadn't solved it. So on one end, you have some level of sympathy. You're saying, well, if they could, they thought they had fixed it. But on the other end, if they couldn't reproduce it, how could they know that they had fixed it? You can't say that. I mean, it's one of those things where they were so sure it was the batteries themselves. I believe they'd been using a different manufacturer or something like that, their supplier. They switched it to another one that had been working and they thought that would fix it. And it clearly wasn't that. It's a little worrying that as far as I know, they still don't know what actually caused it.
Yeah.
And, you know, Samsung has the money to figure this out. So the other thing is, I mean, this was a huge phone, and it not only, like, I'm not interested in this phone even as an Android user, but it had been touted as the best phone. Like, my friend who wanted the Note 7, it's funny, he got a Galaxy Edge as a replacement device. The Galaxy Edge is 0.2 inches smaller in screen size. It's 5.5 versus 5.7, and he never uses the stylus. So I really don't know why he would really want the Note above the Edge, because as far as I know, they have the same internals and the same camera, so I have no idea what would make him want, I have to have the Note 7.
Yeah.
But there was some feeling about it that the Note 7 was, like, the best device. And that obviously hurts Samsung's brand. It's such an oddity, because I mean, right now they kind of have three. I mean, I don't know how you classify it, but like three flagship level phones. They have the S7, S7 Edge, and the Note 7. And the Note 7 is the only one having these severe problems. I mean, I don't think they've had any of these problems consistently in the past. So it's crazy that they've gotten so, it's so wrong on this device. But this is a huge blow to them, and I don't know what they're going to do moving forward.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Well, it's not 100% clear to me from what I've read, but I feel like it's not just the Note 7 is gone, but probably the Note brand is gone.
Yeah, a lot of people are talking about that.
And so they might still bring back a stylus, but it would probably be branded as something else and a whole new phone or an offshoot of the Galaxy or something like that, the Galaxy Pen or something, I don't know. I think they're saying that they're writing off about $2 billion in losses. You know, Samsung is a very diversified company. I grew up in Korea, and Samsung is everything. Like, you know, back in the 80s, GE was everywhere, and they did everything, and it's kind of like that. Like, Samsung is that to the max. We don't have a company like Samsung in this country anymore because of anti-competitive laws and stuff like that. But Samsung is a conglomerate. You know, they make car parts. They make all kinds of chips for other companies to use. They make any number of consumer electronics and durable goods. So appliances, et cetera, et cetera. They make they have part ownership of shipping agencies and all kinds of stuff. So they even have their own baseball team, right? So it's like
they have StarCraft teams too.
Yeah. So they are probably diversified enough that they won't go out of business. But this is a very serious blow to their mobile branch, at least.
Which I haven't looked at their financials, but I would assume it brings in a decent amount of revenue considering how well they sell. Because I think there's a lot of low margins on some of the other devices they sell. So that's where it gets really tough. I totally agree. If there's any company that can take the hit, it's them. Like, if this had happened to HTC, I mean, it'd be game over easily. But it's still such a big blow. And it's honestly a big blow to Android. Like, I keep reading things. I mean, obviously, they've already reviewed the iPhone 7 a while ago, but I see reviews where they'll be like, oh yeah, and the iPhone, like, this is the phone that doesn't blow up, as though like all Android phones blow up. And like I said, I mean, it is a very serious thing, so I don't want to downplay that, but it's weird to think they have three high-end phones, and even of those three, only one is, like, they've made many, many phones in the past. They've had this one huge problem, and this is really going to stick out. So I don't know how this is going to go going forward. I can't, if they lose customers, I honestly, well, we'll talk about it in the next segment. I can only see them going one of two ways. Either they go into the Pixel or they just go to the iPhone. I don't think it's going to be like, oh, I can't get a Note, so now I'm going to get an LG. Like, I don't think anybody else has enough of a brand strength. I think it's just back to, well, the Pixel is a strong competitor, and then it's back to iPhone.
Yeah, I think some people will stay with Samsung and go to the Edge or the Galaxy. The issue that I see for them is not so much in this country, but in other countries, namely India and China, where, you know, they were already having a little bit of trouble staying as a front runner, as a premium Android phone, because they're a little more expensive than the other Android phones. And so, you know, some of these phones exploded in China, and they actually, so it's a little problematic, because they were like, when they started exploding around the world, mostly in the US and in Europe, Samsung said, oh, no, the phones that you're getting in China, because they, you know how they delay the sales, right?
So
the sales were slightly delayed in that they went on sale in China the day that these reports were coming out about the phones exploding. And they looked at the manufacturing of the battery locations, which plant they were in, and they're like, oh, no, these Chinese phones are fine. And they sold them anyway, and then the Chinese phones started exploding too, because they clearly had no idea as to why these phones were exploding. So, you know, just the mix of the arrogance there. I don't want to say arrogance, but they took a gamble. They took a risk there, and they got caught. And then the rivalry between South Korea and China, just those countries. I really think that their brand is going to be most damaged in China because of this. So, and you know, the Chinese media will take this and with their very nationalistic approach and spin this out the wazoo. So I really think their biggest write-offs are going to be in China, not so much in the U.S.
That makes sense.
So then, I mean, since we're talking about Google phones,
one phone to the next, yeah.
We have to talk about, so the next big competitor I kind of alluded to was the Google Pixel. So the Google Pixel pre-orders were, and the unveiling was a little while ago, but now reviews are coming out. So we're seeing people with hands-on of it. My sense is mostly positive, some mixed. Basically, one of the big negative things, and I can't stress this enough because it still irritates me, I don't care if it's Google doing it, or I don't care if it's a Chinese manufacturer doing it, or Google doing it. They didn't, when they did the design, they basically went with an iPhone.
I don't get it. I legitimately do not understand why so many companies have copied this design.
So I think
I don't even think it was a good design to begin with.
I think one of two things. One thing I thought, which is probably less probable. So HTC was the manufacturer of this phone. I believe their A9, which was not this year but last year, looked very much like an iPhone. Maybe that built into it because the Nexus devices were kind of designed in partnership. That's one. I don't think that's probable. The other thing, a lot of people have said this. It makes sense. I still hate it though. The idea is people know the iPhone. They like the iPhone. So go. It's a safe device shape to go with, and so it's like better than going with, and admittedly a lot of Nexus phones have been attacked for having boring designs. So it's a question of, do we get attacked for being a copycat but people still like it, so we kind of get a hit to our ego, or do we try to make a new device and it looks boring and we get attacked because it's boring looking? So I can understand why you would want to go for a device that looks better. I don't get it. I think the Chromebook Pixel looked great, so you'd think they have some design chops to do this. And HTC has put out some really eye-popping designs in the past, but whatever. I mean, we can rehash that forever. Anyway, besides that, though, it sounds like, without a doubt, it's a really high-quality phone. It's really fast, has enough RAM. A big point was the camera, and apparently the camera is really, really good. And I even looked at pictures, and it does look solid. So and it's very fast, which is big. One small point, we were looking at a video earlier, so it doesn't have optical image stabilization, but it does, only on videos, it has EIS. Electronic image stabilization? I don't know.
Yeah,
it's all software, and it actually works really well. But it's very cinematic. I think that's how you put it, Josiah, which I liked. Because it's so stable, it almost looks, to me, it looked a little unusual because it literally looks like it's a film, where I'm not used to that on just a phone that you use. The battery life, that it's odd, has been a mixed bag. I've seen more reviews that were positive on the battery life than not, but some people were saying that it wasn't that great. Everybody was saying the larger phone has good battery life, but the larger phones tend to. But that probably speaks to how Android works and that it can honestly be inconsistent. And honestly, I really don't trust any battery reviews because all the reviews people do, it just, the bigger difference is when you're actually using the phone. Like, people have benchmarks and you play videos. I understand their methodology, but it's never the same as when you have your own apps on there and your use case, even when they're using for a couple of days.
Yeah.
So you have to wait till people actually have it.
Yeah. Yeah. I usually try to triangulate that and try to get a sense of it. But what you said, Sean, it's ultimately, what notifications do you have on? What background apps do you have running? And are you on Wi-Fi or are you on cellular? Most of the time, cellular eats up more battery, that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's kind of a wait and see.
And particularly, I will say, I've always found with the iPhone, sounds a little silly, but when you're using it, it drains battery a lot. But when you're not using it, because of how it manages background data or whatever, it just sips battery. And Android, their workaround is you just have much larger batteries. And so they don't have necessarily that discrepancy, but it's not sipping power when you're not using it. So it can be draining just as consistently.
All I know is Pokemon Go eats their shit out of my battery.
Pokemon Go, it's just an F unit batteries. But also another big part of it is that Android 7.1 Nougat is on there. So that, I mean, other phones are going to get that. I think one positive thing is obviously the Pixel is going to get updates faster than other phones, hopefully on the same line as the Nexus devices, and hopefully... We'll have to see, but hopefully the support for the device lasts longer than 2 years, but so far it hasn't been that, so we don't know. But another big thing is Google Assistant. So far, this is exclusive to Pixel. There have been talks that Assistant is going to come to Nexus devices and everybody else. I don't know.
Modders have been able to get it on Nexus devices.
And Google said, we're going to give OEMs access to all of these tools. It seems ridiculous that it wouldn't be on the next device, but we don't know. The whole idea, we talked about this before, the idea is the Pixel is its own phone. It's no longer stock Android, it's Google's skin on Android.
Yeah,
so that's what makes the launcher
to
different.
To that point, right, it is Google's phone, it's not a Nexus, and that brings up the other kind of big ding on this in the reviews that I've looked at, is that people are still in sticker shock. And we talked about this a little bit when it was announced a couple weeks ago. And so to that end, I mean, let's hash this out. Just around the table very quickly. Do you think the price is too high, Sean?
I honestly don't. I really...
No. I think it... For,
I thought you did.
Well... For
it's
me,
too high for us
me,
to buy, right?
For
I think
me.
That's what we said
think,
last week.
I think if I was looking, if I did not just buy the Nexus, the 6P, I think I would buy this phone.
Right. As a replacement phone, I'd shell it out. Like if I were an Android user and I was just replacing my phone, no problem. I wouldn't bat an eye. But I was looking at an Android device as a companion just to fool around with. And it's way too much for me to just justify a secondary phone.
And so like you said, almost every review I saw dinged it on price. And this kind of goes into the whole Android mentality. So one thing I totally understand.
Is it the same price as the new iPhone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Galaxy
S7.
So that's the whole thing, what it gets into. And this is actually a thing that permeates Android and some of the mentalities. So one of the reasons why prices dinged, we talked about this, the Nexus devices were a lot cheaper. You can also, the OnePlus 3 is... $400. The last year's Moto X was $400. And there are tons of Chinese OEMs that are making really cheap phones. And so the thing is, though, the top manufacturers, I mean, you expect the Samsung phone to be $650. You expect the iPhone to be $650. This is a normal price in line with that. And Android devices, there is some level of cheapness that you expect out of it. This also relates to app buying. People have consistently talked, and it's totally true, people spend more money on the App Store. And I don't think it's always, the app is just that much better on the iPhone. I think it ends up being people are used to paying money on the iPhone, and they're comfortable with it. Yeah. And they're totally fine with it. And so this is that kind of mentality that builds an Android, that everything has to be cheap. And that's why I don't think the price... It makes any less sense than Samsung pricing at $650 or the iPhone being at $650. And in the same way, and this was the problem, and I understand it from most of the reviewers, a lot of reviewers, it sounds like, use iPhones as a primary device. There's this feeling of... It always feels like the alternate. It's like, well, maybe I'll try it, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas if you see it as... I prefer Android, and I don't want to get into all this, but I have a lot of reasons why I think Android is a better OS... this is the top-end phone. The major problem I have is that it uninspired design. It's basically copying the iPhone. I have a problem with that. At least, admittedly, it still seems like it's a good phone. Like, it's all metal, besides the glass on the back. Like, at least it's well-built. But it's still, like, that's glaring. The only thing I can think of is hopefully Gen 2 of the Pixel will be... They'll be more daring in their design decisions. But I don't know. $650 definitely will be a problem. And I think that might be a real problem in terms of sales. But I think it's perfectly understandable in that most high-end devices tend to be at that price point.
Yeah, I think, you know, like you said, people are still... They still have that memory of the Nexus. So that's the Google phone. And that was typically much cheaper, $100 or $150 cheaper, roughly, depending on the size and the model and blah, blah, blah. And then, like you said, there are a bunch of other quote-unquote flagship phones from some of these Chinese vendors and even HTC and LG, a little bit cheaper than the Samsung and the iPhone stuff out there. So I get that. And I think, you know, if you want to make a comparison, I'd say that the price point for the Pixel is more courageous than Apple dropping the headphone jack.
Really?
No, I think it is a problem. It's a known problem that, and this is what you know, Steve Jobs was hated for, but also brilliant for sticking to, and that is, like he said, in many different ways, I'm not going to sell a cheap product. My product is not for cheap people. That's not to say that it's for only rich people, but it's not for cheap people. It's for people who will pay for quality. And that's something that's hard to build up if you start with the other type of customer, right? It's hard to convert people into paying for certain types of things. And so he said, I'm going to start at the top with people who are willing to pay for what they perceive to be quality, and then that will trickle out, and people will say, oh, I want to aspire to that and buy that, not say, oh, I'm gonna get this cheap thing and that sort of thing, right? Because even if you start out cheap, you're still aspiring to the higher quality. So I think this is a kind of a big reset moment. I think it's I feel like Google had to know this, that it's not good enough just to change the name of the phone from Nexus to Pixel and say, oh, well, it's a completely different phone. People will pay for it. So they had to know that they were going to get some pushback on this price point. And I think it's the smart and right thing to do to build that culture around their product.
And just I just quickly looked it up. So HTC's latest phone was $600, and the LG G5 was, I think, $650. It was $650. So the higher, it's weird. I mean, I think it's more that the lower end manufacturers have found ways to cut into that price. But I totally agree on your point.
The LG G5, I mean, isn't that's the size of the Plus though, right?
It might be, but that's just their flagship. I don't think they have a Plus version.
Yeah, but I'm saying the LG G5 is as big as the iPhone 7 Plus, and as big as the larger version of the Google Pixel. So it's still discounted compared to those prices, because when you go up to the larger size, it's $100 more.
Well, sort of, and this is what's gotten confusing with Android. So the thing is. Oh no, it's 5.3 inches, so that's a smaller size.
Is it? Okay.
Well, actually, it's funny. It's kind of in the middle because, like, the iPhone is 4.7 and 5.5, and these phones, like my, so that's, I think it's on the smaller end.
Yeah.
I think the Pixel is 5 inches. I'm not 100% sure, but it's funny. So the OnePlus One, The OnePlus 3 is a 5.5 inch phone, and it's $400. Okay. Same thing. Yeah. The Moto X
and
is a
the,
big phone.
What's the other one? The Huawei Honor is. A lot of people have been talking about that lately.
So I actually, when you look at it, it almost feels like it doesn't necessarily cost that much more to get a size that big, because now it's easier to get LCD screens. I think one difference. So for example, actually in the Pixel as well, on the iPhone and the Pixel, the screen on the bigger size is actually higher resolution. So like the iPhone 7 Plus has a 1080p screen. The Pixel XL has a quad HD screen.
Yeah.
So you're actually seeing a bump. So I could see some increase in price and things like that. Obviously, the iPhone 7 Plus also has a second camera.
Yep.
But either way, we'll see what happens. I think it's a fair price, but I agree it's going to get pushback, and I think it's going to be harder to sell. But if there's any phone to sell, I think this is a really quality device, and I'm excited about it.
Yeah. So I think fair price, best quality phone out there for Android platform, and we'll have to see if is well reviewed. We'll have to see if it actually sells.
Yeah.
Because right now phone company selling it is Verizon.
They sold out quickly on the Play Store, but selling out numbers are a terrible terrible metric, because it's really hard to tell how many they actually had in stock.
All right, so let's move on to the change up, which is brought to you by Green Man Gaming. You can get 20% off the latest games by going to the Commentist website and clicking on the banner. Change up for this week is, what would you want to learn or study online?
How to get a life.
Oh, I don't think you'll find it there.
Yeah, it's not on the internet.
I mean, I've talked about this, and I'll talk about this more, but I've been doing, I think learning languages, especially coding languages in general.
That's a very different language than I immediately thought of.
Well, no, even regular language learning, though, I think there's a lot of opportunity like if you're Skyping with somebody for practice sessions, like because you can hear you know, somebody speak it and things like that. But coding by far has been a good thing for me to learn online.
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, we're definitely the nerd crowd, so I'd say that's the obvious answer, and is fairly true for me as well, coding or languages. And just to throw out another option there is some of the creative stuff that I've learned as far as like photography and things like that, and how to do some good framing and what some of the terminology means. I haven't done any formal like laid out courses along that line, but I have, you know, kind of made my own curriculum, so to speak.
So I've actually taken some courses online. I took some Coursera courses, and I'll admit,
what'd you take?
Well, so I took an accounting class, and then I took a like a data science class because I don't know SAS, and I needed to learn some SAS. The funny thing is, so the accounting class, just because I wanted to learn some things that I didn't know, so it was generally just me learning. And admittedly, I was pulled in like it was a professor from Wharton, so I'm thinking, oh, this will be a good class. I thought it was fine. I think what I found best about it was that there were just tests I could take at the end, because that's it also goes into what kind of learner you are.
Yeah.
I didn't think any of the PowerPoints, because it's basically PowerPoints and some video. It's PowerPoints and people, I guess, narrating or talking over it. I thought they were well produced, but it didn't feel like I was like, I don't know, I didn't feel like I was learning at a greater rate than I would otherwise. So I liked doing it. I think it's cool, especially considering how many of those are actually free. So it's really cool that you can get that kind of stuff. But I don't know if there's anything else on my head that I want to learn right now. But I think a lot of thing that would work really well, things that you that are helped when you visualize it, like you said, coding. If somebody can look at your code, or you can see how it works, or with coding, you can also, like, there'll be a box and you can type and it'll tell you if you're wrong or not.
Yeah.
Same thing with math. Sometimes it helps a lot when you see the equation written out or something like that. Sometimes visualizing it is just nicer. And so those are the kinds of things I could see a lot of help with.
Yep.
But yeah.
All right, so we bring up this idea of what would you want to learn online, because our last topic today is just online learning. So Rob and I have been looking at this for a while. We've been kind of floating around this. We used to do another podcast specifically about education technology, and we've talked about MOOCs like Coursera, edX, Udacity, those types of things. Even Udemy.
MOOC is an acronym, right? When I first heard it, I was like, wait, well, you call me a MOOC?
What is it?
Massively
open online courses.
Okay.
Yeah. So
cousin of an MMO.
Yeah. Not another word that ends in ook. But you could call me that if you wanted. But we'll save that for another day.
That's for the uncensored podcast.
Yeah. But the idea again is, you know, online learning. It hits so many different levels, right? So this idea of place shifting, time shifting, you do it when you want, where you want. Because of the scale, we're now looking at some courses being offered by traditionally campus-focused universities, namely the big one that's been floating around is Georgia Tech. They're offering a legit master's in computer science. And it's something that you actually have to apply to.
Yep.
You have to have you have to have certain grade level and a background in computer science to begin with and that sort of thing. And there's an admissions board. But their normal costs, I think they said, would be about $70,000. They cut it in for a master's, a 2-year master's program.
Oh, sorry.
And so the online course is $7,000.
Huh.
So 1/10 the amount.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah, but it's the same lecture series that you're going through. It's the same tests and projects that you're going through. So it's a legit master's in CS. So Sean, you want to respond?
Yeah. Well, one quick thing before we even get into, I guess, the viability. How do you think from a university standpoint? Like, I think one thing, one consistent thing, at least in American universities, is the cost of tuition keeps going up, and you know, people talk about the value of education and all that, but universities sell their education. Like, they're saying that it's worth this much. So how do you tell regular, quote, regular CS majors at Georgia Tech? I don't know how this works, that, yeah, it's totally fine to pay $70,000 if you want to be on campus, but you could get this same degree for $7,000. Like, how do they make that pitch? Because normally, at the end of the day, a Coursera degree, and we'll probably get into this, it still means something. I think people are realizing it's valuable, but it's not felt the same way as getting a degree at a traditional university.
Yeah, so this might be some, there might be some cannibalism, so to speak, of their own student body. But they did the numbers, and I heard an interview with one of the main professors in charge of the department, and he said so far the numbers are working as far as they had to get a number, like get to scale, right? They had to get enough people to do the online program that they could afford it, afford to sell it at that much. And they figured out their profit margin and whatever, or whatever you want to call it for a public university, but they figured out their margins and they're hitting them.
Which, I mean, yeah, truthfully thinking about it, that makes sense, because getting a master's, or is it a master's or a bachelor's?
It's a master's.
Okay, it's a master's. Getting from, and Georgia Tech is a good school, like for engineering. This isn't some random school. That's definitely valid. I mean, they probably have the most expensive app on the App Store. Just pay $7,000. But that makes sense. I can see how it's viable. I guess it's some cannibalism, and the question is, how do you not offend your own students? And this gets into, I don't think we wanted to necessarily talk about it, but the question of the value of education in terms of like how much. But if you want to, I mean, we don't need to get into
that. Well, I mean, it's a tough question that people need to ask themselves. So not to get too far off topic, but I've felt, and I've had conversations with Rob. This was actually one of the first serious conversations that Rob and I had when we first met each other, maybe 3 years ago, was, you know, what's the value of education? And like, what are the degrees that you feel are worth paying for? Because, you know, I've known a lot of people as a teacher. I've mentored a lot of students that are applying to school. And I myself had to go to grad school and all this stuff. And I've looked at postgraduate degrees, not doctorates. But, you know, and I have to weigh this. And so I know that with a certain class of people in this country, it's just like, oh yeah, you have to go to college, and oh yeah, you have to, you know, why wouldn't you want to get a master's, or why wouldn't you want to get a doctorate? And but then you have to stop and think, like, that's a lot of fucking money you're paying for this stuff.
Yeah.
What's the return on investment? And so, you know, people have to start asking that, not just do I want a degree, but how do I want to get my degree? Is it worth the extra factor 10 to be on campus and have access to office hours and blah blah blah, and have my colleagues around me in a cohort and learn from them and have that conversation and you know, that sort of thing? Or can I actually learn this online? And I would argue that for different content areas, it's going to be a very different answer, and obviously for different people. So you know, it's weird when you stop and think about it in those terms. It's very democratizing at first blush, but then you start to say, well, not necessarily. It's going to trend towards people who have the time and the familiarity and the comfort with technology. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that's a bit of a wash because this is a CS major, so pretty much everybody applying. But when you start applying it to other majors,
which, like, will certainly happen.
You're going to have that breakdown of people who know the technology and they can learn online versus people who have never experienced technology, and now they're stuck going to a campus experience that's potentially a lot more expensive.
Yeah, so to speak to that, I think a lot of it depends on the learner, right? So what type of learner you are. So I can actually speak to both experiences. So I went to a master's program traditionally at a school, and now I'm doing...
Now you have three University of Phoenix PhDs.
Yeah. I started with Udacity. So I was looking at the CS major Josiah was mentioning. And the interesting thing about online learning is that you can find programs that better tailor your needs, I think. So as I was looking through the traditional CS major was like, you know, information technology and like operating systems, like all these like really high level concepts, which as I got into it, I was like, this doesn't really interest me. It's not really as hands-on and not coding as much as I want to. So I shopped around a little bit. I found Udacity, which has these nano degrees. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, also known as Udacity.
Udacity?
I saw that. Udacity, man. Udacity.
Udacity is the same partner that was working with Georgia Tech to offer that master's.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. So I was looking at, there are other offerings. Mm-hmm. Udacity has these nano degrees, which you are self-paced. And they actually, and they're focused, right? So they have Android for beginners, so they have a whole nano degree, so they break down the courses, things like that. And then that takes about 6 months or so, I think, if you go through the whole thing at the pace they suggest. And then they also have an intermediate, like legit Android developer program, which interestingly enough, they guarantee you job placement.
That's kind of
within
crazy.
6 months
how that
of graduating,
works.
Right?
Like that's a very crazy
so
stipulation.
What I've been able to figure out about it is it's up to you to actually apply for jobs. So you have to prove that you are actively seeking and you're like, you know, not just not taking jobs, like entry level jobs and things like that.
Yeah. And just to clarify, I don't. They're not saying they're going to place you.
No,
they're,
no.
It's
but
a
they
money
have
back guarantee.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. So they refund you your whole tuition, which is $200 a month. So again, if you're self-paced, if you're doing this full time and you can finish it in a few months, like you're talking about, you know, all of the knowledge that you would need for this position for, you know, under $1,000 versus the tens of thousands you'd be spending going to a campus.
By the way, imagine if regular universities offered a money back guarantee. Yeah. Like, oh wait, all all law schools just go out of business.
Yeah. But it's interesting. So I've been telling people about this, and so my girlfriend works in college admissions, and I was telling her like, oh, you know, I want to do this program, and she's like, well, it's not from a college, like, are you sure you can get a job doing this?
Yeah.
Like, are jobs going to look at you the same way that they would somebody coming out of a college? And my mom actually had the exact same response to it. And it makes sense. And I think if you're applying to maybe more traditional jobs with that have, like, you know, a couple programming jobs, they'll probably be looking, like, people who can't evaluate your skill on site, they'll probably be looking for traditional degrees versus more forward tech companies like Google and all these and startups.
So the university name is a proxy for quality, right?
Right. So but now it's especially with something like coding where it's moving more towards can you prove that you can do X, Y, and Z? And now that you and this course and this program builds up a portfolio that you can then go take to job interviews and say, oh, here's an example of this and how I implemented and things like that.
But I mean, The point is valid, right? So will people hire you with this experience?
Right.
But it's the same old story in this country, right? So it used to be, well, you should really try to go to Ivy League because that's going to get you the network and the reputation that you need to get a job. And then it's like, well, no, there's actually some really good private schools out there too. And then they said, well, no, there's actually some really good state schools out there too. And now it's, well, no, there's some really good you know, community college programs for different types of career paths, et cetera. You don't always need a four-year degree, or you can do your associates and then transfer. And so, you know, people are expanding as we have very practical needs in the workplace. People have to acknowledge, like, the smart hiring, the smart managers and bosses are the ones that are going to acknowledge that, yeah, I can get a faster, more flexible, cheaper workforce by accepting different types of degrees. And it's going to take a little while for that to get vetted and for people to wrap their brains around it, but it will happen. And it's going to happen, like I already said, in certain areas much faster. So obviously you pointed out, like, can the boss or manager or potential hiring person figure out your skill set? So programming is very, very much geared towards portfolios, right? And you think of other portfolio jobs like photography and other creative jobs. Like, a lot of times you don't have to go to school, right?
Yeah,
if I have a portfolio to show you, even as a writer, I could show you a portfolio or show you my writing, and I don't have to go to school just for that. So that's the obvious in, right? That's where it's going to be the most impact and the most uptake for people who have jobs that you can see a portfolio or body of work and judge their skill set and their aptitudes.
I should also point out the Udacity courses, I'm sure some of the ones on Coursera, they're developed with partners, right? So like the Android degree program was developed with Google as a partner with this.
Yeah. And same thing, like even Coursera and edX.
Yeah.
EdX is almost entirely MIT and Harvard because it stemmed from they had a partnership before edX that just eventually transitioned into edX. Coursera has I took a course from Wharton School, which is UPenn, on Coursera, and they've got Michigan University and Stanford, a bunch of partners.
Well, actually, Udacity is from Stanford. They built out. That's where that. But I think you guys make great points. I mean, it's really a question of, and tech is clearly the place where having a portfolio, even programmers, I mean, web design, all those places, portfolio is more important than your degree. I clearly remember there was a video series that The Verge did called Small Empires, where they followed some startups.
Right.
And Squarespace, which is pretty huge now, they interviewed all the developers there, and literally all of them learned on their own. It wasn't their, a lot of them, I don't even think had CS degrees, if I remember correctly. And then it also gets into the whole debate, which is much wider ranging, of the question of like, what part of a degree is academia? Like, I still remember, you know, I learned about statistics and I learned how to do it by hand. And you know what? There is no way in hell I'm going to go to any job and they're going to make me do it by hand. You're using software for it.
Right.
But in academia, you learn it from the base. You learn how it actually works. And so some of these courses allow you to kind of skip that element sometimes and maybe get to what you really want to know, which is really useful. And this is what I've heard with a lot of programmers. You know, you learn whatever, Ruby on Rails, you learn C# or something like that, and you learn how to really use it. Maybe you don't understand everything of how it works, but you know how to use it. And in addition, I mean, there's so many opportunities to do this that I think that's where people are going to be looking for hiring. And programming, I think, used to be, oh, this is computer science. Now programming kind of underpins everything, because everybody's making an app. Everybody is built on software. Like, you know what? If you're a hospital, you're using EHR technology. If you're making an app, obviously you're using that. Like, so many things have technology under it that programming is part of everything now, that I think that could be really useful. I don't know, though, if, you know, getting a literature degree, say. I mean, even taking out the fact that it's difficult to get a position in that field anyway, I don't know if an online course in that, maybe it would.
I mean, I would go the disruptive route and just say, like, why do you need a literature degree in the first place? Whether it's from Harvard or whether it's, like, it would be semi-valuable from Harvard because you're buying a network, right?
Yeah.
But beyond that, beyond certain programs, certain universities, I don't know if it's worthwhile to get a degree in literature. And this was the conversation that I was having with Rob. Like, you can get a degree in whatever you want to get a degree in, but it doesn't mean that that's going to lead to a career path. So you have to know that. I'm not saying it's stupid to do that, but it would be irresponsible to do it without thinking about your career path based on the choice that you're about to make, right? So, you know, and I can say I'm guilty too, right? Like, I have a degree in biology, and that's really just pre something, right?
Yeah.
Because a BS in biology is not terribly marketable.
Yeah.
It gets you into the door for other things, and that's eventually what I turned it into. I got a BS in biology and a master's in science education, and that turned into a career path for me. But yeah, so I think, you know, this idea of nano degrees that Rob brought up, and a lot of these other online courses, they're offering either just the course or a certain certification, right? Because this idea of a whole master's, I would even say, is up for a rude awakening soon, right? Like, because when you look at that course of study, great, it's Georgia Tech is offering this for cheaper online, but I could still go in there and argue, like, yeah, I don't need this, I don't need this, I don't need this, depending on what my objectives are. If my objectives are career focused, and not academia, because famously academics want to train more academics.
Yeah.
They're not, most of them don't want to train people to go get jobs, right? And that's why they had a wake-up call when all these community colleges started getting people who were, you know, mid-20s to mid-30s and saying, you know, I don't have time to go to this four-year program that has a bunch of filler courses that I don't see the need for. I have a job now, and I need to get a better job. So give me courses that are going to give me skills to get a better job. So I think that's a competition, you know. And there will still be some small population that wants to have that fully fledged kind of humanities based whatever conversational educational thing that they can apply in very creative
ways. Josiah was a science teacher. You can't tell.
but I think for many, many people, they just need a job. Yeah. And they need choices and they need options.
Either that or further what they're currently doing, right? So yeah. An additional skill that they don't have in their job.
And I think, I don't know if we're in agreement, but I think a lot of this, where it gets interesting, is really master's and potentially above. I'm not sure PhD, it's also in the middle, but bachelor's, to me, bachelor's in a weird way almost feels like an extension of high school where you're still learning how to think. So there's a whole different experience with a bachelor's. At least in America, I feel like it's a different expectation. So I see the use of this is when you're trying to learn hard skills and trying to learn how to actually do stuff versus sometimes when earlier on in your education where you might, there are other advantages to, you're literally growing up. So
yeah, there are other ways to grow up.
I could grow up online.
You can join the army.
Yeah.
They'll help you grow up, right? Like that's an option that used to be a very popular choice. And I don't see why, I don't want to talk about why I think it's been subverted, but that's the route my father took, right? Because he is from a working class family, the oldest of four children, and he joined the military because it was an opportunity for him to get education and quote unquote grow up, right? The idea that we have to send our kids to college and pay, you know, $50,000 or more a year. So we're coming out with $200,000 of debt for some kid to fucking grow up. It's insane to me, but we do it to ourselves.
Yeah.
So that's not a blast on anybody who's done that. Again, that is an option, but it's not the only option. So we have to stop telling ourselves that's the best way to do it, because I could make many arguments that it's very inefficient.
And that is totally, that could fill up an entire podcast easily. I'm not going to respond to that right now.
All right. So that is going to do it for this week's episode of The Unwind. Thank you so much for listening. You can subscribe to us on the iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Store. You can find us on YouTube by searching for The Commentist. Please share us with your friends. Leave us comments. You can submit questions and topics to us directly by going to theunwind.audio. Also, be sure to check out thecommentist.com, where you can see all of our great podcasts, such as
Kiss the Crest,
Bearded Vegans,
Sky The Unwind. Wow, we're all just talking
about each
other. Just lots of good stuff.
Go. Just go.
So we are now happy to announce that the Commentist University is offering a master's in podcasting. It's actually only $3,000, so you're actually saving a lot of money from this Georgia Tech University.
Yeah, nice.
But go to our website to sign up.